Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tonight we do a deep dive into the future of Pacific Gas and Electric, better known as PG&E, one of the largest combined natural gas and electric utilities in the United States. PG&E serves customers throughout most of Northern California, including right here in the Bay Area. Now, between its bankruptcy, lawsuits, liabilities, and future risks due to climate change, what is the troubled company's path forward? Despite its challenges, PG&E's stock price has actually risen in recent weeks, surprising many, but all involved parties seem on edge about the bankruptcy's impact on them. Most recently, renewable energy companies expressed concern that bankruptcy will allow PG&E to cancel contracts with them. So who should bear the cost of PG&E's financial burdens? Ratepayers? Shareholders? Will wildfire victims get appropriate compensation? Is it even possible to deliver electricity safely in California? And should San Francisco create its own utility? Well, tonight, I'm pleased to be joined by the following guests who will help us make sense of all of this. Joining me by phone is Severin Bornstein, professor of business administration and public policy at the Haas School of Business and faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas. Welcome, Severin.
Thanks. Nice to be on.
And we're pleased to be joined as well by phone by Catherine Sandoval, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University and former Commissioner for the California Public Utilities Commission, the agency that regulates investor-owned utilities like PG&E. Welcome, Catherine.
Thank you very much.
And we're also very pleased to be joined here in the studio by Supervisor Hillary Ronan from San Francisco's District 9. Welcome, Hillary.
Thank you so much.
And in 20 minutes, we'll invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. You can dial that number in. We'll open the phone lines in 20 minutes. The number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. But if you have a question right now, you can send those questions or comments for our panel at any time by emailing us at cityvisions@kalw.org. So, Catherine, let me start with you. I wanted to give listeners the latest news on what the status of PG&E is. Can you fill in for listeners where the company is right now in terms of this bankruptcy proceeding?
Right. So the bankruptcy court has held its first hearings and considered what they call the first day motions, including motions which allow PG&E to spend money to keep service flowing. And also they considered some motions which were more controversial, for example, motions about some existing bonus plans and whether or not that should be included in spending money. And so they also got approval for a line of credit, which they said was needed to keep operating. And so it's given them money to keep operating for a while. But there's also that needs a final approval after a meeting of the creditors committee. So there's more to come.
So the bankruptcy proceeding has just started. They're just getting rolling in this. And a lot of people are asking what's going to happen. Are the lights going to stay on? What do you tell people, Catherine, about the near-term implications for ratepayers, for people who depend on electricity, natural gas service? What should we be expecting, if anything, to change?
Right. So this is also part of the idea of being able to get the financing, is that this is financing to help them continue to operate. And the first and foremost obligation is to continue to provide safe, reliable electric and gas utility service at just and reasonable rates consistent with California's environmental law. So they have represented to the judge and the CPUC that they can continue to do that. So in the short term, we haven't seen any evidence that service is actually endangered. But one of the questions is also with if they continue to have a problem with access to credit, that could also be something that could create a problem with regard to service. For example, if they can't buy natural gas or they can only buy by paying up front.
Mm-hmm. So the lights will stay on, which I'm sure is good news for people who are listening under lights right now. And how did we get to this point? I mean, I just wanted to give listeners a sense of the update here. But Catherine, can you explain for people how we're at this point now where this incredibly large, important, critical utility is now in bankruptcy court?
Well, I think we're still unraveling the answer to that question, because it is important to note that PG&E is not insolvent in terms of when you compare their assets and liabilities. They said that they have $71 billion in assets, and then they have $51 billion in debt. So they're not insolvent. However, they're saying that the problem becomes that they face massive potential liabilities because of various lawsuits, including the lawsuits from the fire victim. One thing that I thought was noteworthy about their filing in bankruptcy is that they didn't really break down the number that they allege constitutes the $30 billion in liabilities, and they didn't readjust it after there was the finding that, in fact, they were not responsible for the Tubbs fire. So I think we're still trying to figure that out, but also I think part of the problem is that they have not always been forthcoming about what some of their problems were, and this is part of what led the PUC to file a case revealing for the first time certain allegations relating to their gas locate and mark program.
So we have a lot of question marks around how we got to this point, and I guess we'll see as the bankruptcy proceeding kind of unravels a little bit or unveils itself what exactly the story is with PG&E's finances. Severin Bornstein, wanted to bring you into the conversation. Can you explain for listeners how PG&E is structured? Because I think a lot of people don't really know too much about the nature of this company. So would you be able to explain for listeners some of the business components and why it's not a typical public company?
Well, I can explain a part of it. I'm certainly no expert in financial structuring, but PG&E, the utility, is actually part of PG&E Corp, which is a corporation that essentially owns the utility and has at other times owned other assets as well. The utility is divided up into a gas side and an electric side. Now, the way a utility like this operates is it operates like a regular corporation, selling product and making profits, but the prices it charges are regulated. So unlike a normal corporation that can charge whatever price it wants, they are clearly charging less than they could charge. It's a monopoly. They could charge a very high price because we need electricity, and they aren't able to do that due to regulation. And that's why when a utility goes into bankruptcy, we start to see a conflict, because the bankruptcy judges mandate is to get the money that the creditors are owed. And as we saw 18 years ago with the last PG&E bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge sees the ability to raise price and make more profits as one way to raise money for the creditors and everyone the company owes. And of course, the regulator, the California Public Utilities Commission, has exactly the opposite view. They view their mandate as protecting consumers and not allowing prices to go higher. So when we get into this sort of bankruptcy, it's very different from just a run-of-the-mill corporation that's selling its product going bankrupt, because we have this third party, not just the bankruptcy judge and the management of the company, but also the regulator is essentially part of the process, and the three entities have to work this out, and all three of them have some management power over the company.
So are you concerned, Severin, that this is going to mean that rates will go up for ratepayers?
Oh, I think it's very likely that rates are going to go up. There's been a huge loss from these wildfires, and somebody has to bear it. If it is found that the utility was negligent or is responsible, the shareholders should and will be the first ones to bear it, but there probably isn't enough shareholder value to completely cover it. So part of this is probably going to have to go elsewhere, be paid elsewhere. Now, one way could be some of the creditors don't get paid, whether they are bondholders who have essentially loaned the company money, or parties who are suing PG&E for losses from the wildfires. One way that will probably be at least partially borne is through higher costs to ratepayers. The CPUC certainly doesn't want to see that happen and will push back against it. But once you have tapped all the shareholder value, you're down to the creditors, the fire victims, and the ratepayers, And I have a feeling all three of those parties are going to end up taking some of the hit.
So in the words of George H.W. Bush, we have to watch our wallets here in terms of what comes out of this proceeding, it sounds like. So I want to bring Supervisor Ronan into this conversation. I'm sure you're hearing from constituents. We just heard from one listener, Carl, who writes, as a grumpy old San Franciscan who watched helplessly as PG&E stalled my ability to buy the clean power promised by SF Clean Power for years, I'd love to see PG&E go under and be replaced by a public power agency. Is that all in play at all in general, or at least here in San Francisco? So, Supervisor Ronan, I imagine you get questions like that. What is your response about the potential for San Francisco to take over PG&E's assets here in the city?
Yes, absolutely, it's in play, and I'm hoping that out of a lot of tragedy and a lot of destruction, much of which is caused by this profit-driven utility, will come something much better, which is a public power, municipally owned and operated utility here in the city and county of San Francisco, that reinvests any additional ratepayer dollars in creating a cleaner energy source that we can then distribute directly to our residents and our customers through a municipally owned grid, and at the same time create good local jobs, provide community benefits, but most importantly operate a safe, reliable, and affordable utility.
And certainly we've seen safety challenges with PG&E, so I know residents here are very concerned about things like the natural gas explosion in San Bruno. But to take over the utility, and this has been a dream, I know, going back over a century for San Francisco to finally own its own utility, that's going to cost a lot of money. I mean, I've read estimates between $3 to $5 billion, maybe more.
Yes.
What do you say in terms of how we're going to raise that dollar, those dollars, to be able to make that purchase?
Well, the voters, made their voices heard on this last November when they approved Proposition A, which gives the Board of Supervisors the ability to issue bonds for the purpose of either buying or building new infrastructure to transmit and distribute energy here in San Francisco. And this is something you have to understand that we're already doing. We operate the Clean Power SF program, where we use PG&E's infrastructure to deliver energy that we either produce, or renewable clean energy that we either produce or buy on the open market. But we also have our Hetch Hetchy side of the utility, where we're producing energy and delivering it directly to our municipal buildings. And so it would really be growing what we already operate and have done quite well with no safety issues for a number of years, quite substantially growing it. But what our initial assessment is that we could issue bonds to cover, between the $1 and $4 billion is the estimates we've been hearing. We'd be able to issue bonds for the purpose of either buying a portion of the grid owned by PG&E and supplementing or building our own.
So you don't think you have to go back to the voters to raise any additional money to do this?
We do not.
Well, that could be a pretty dramatic step. And, of course, you need a willing seller.
That's right.
Is that going to happen in this proceeding? I mean,
that's a question as well. I mean, we'll certainly be presenting our best case and putting our best case forward before the bankruptcy judge, and that's one way of doing it. But we are also looking at what condemnation, eminent domain would look like in this context. And it's a little bit more complicated than normal because we are in the context of a bankruptcy proceeding, but we're not throwing that possibility out the window if we can't convince the bankruptcy judge that a sale to San Francisco is the best option for the utility and its creditors.
And Catherine Sandoval, you are looking at this as a former regulator, I'm sure, and hearing folks like Supervisor Ronan talking about basically breaking up PG&E into little bits, what would be the impacts of municipalities like San Francisco, kind of claiming pieces of PG&E for themselves? What would that mean for ratepayers throughout PG&E's service territory, maybe beyond?
So a couple of things I think about. I agree that we need to look at the governance of PG&E and whether or not the governance should change. And one way to do that is through looking at municipal ownership. And as Supervisor Ronan also recognized, that has several implications, both in terms of the U.S. Constitution requires that there would be just and reasonable compensation if you have to buy it, even through eminent domain if you had to go that way. And, of course, it also requires the maintenance, right, safe, reliable service, which San Francisco says it's committed to. Because I think it's also important to look at the ongoing risk for whoever is the owner is really these days the infrastructure and how the infrastructure risks have changed due to climate change, where we see more swings between drought and rain, as well as more dying trees. That may be less of an issue in San Francisco than in other places, but that is a risk. So the two other quick points, which is that number one, that when you look at things like liability, the liability that PG&E is facing related to these wildfires is not contingent upon negligence, because California has this law called inverse condemnation. It's in the California Constitution that recognizes if the utility's operation ends up taking property, real property, like a house, or personal property, like your car, and it ends up taking it, whether or not the utility is negligent, they're liable. So this concept applies to municipal utilities as well. So we need to look at how do we make sure that the resources are there and the rules are there so that we really are managing the infrastructure risk to account for the changes.
Well, and that's an important point what you brought up about this kind of absolute liability for a utility that causes a fire in this situation. And it seems like I want to talk about fires in depth in a little bit, but you know, just to kind of jump into this now, it seems like there's a lot of parties that would have liability when it comes to the severity of these fires. It's not just the source of the ignition. So do you think there's a possibility that inverse condemnation doctrine might change coming out of this, that we need to re-examine how we apportion liability for these kinds of climate change-induced events like the wildfires?
So inverse condemnation is in the California Constitution, and there's a higher threshold in order to change the California Constitution. So you would need either a certain amount of the legislature to put at a ballot initiative and then have the members of the public change things via ballot initiative. People could run their own ballot initiative, or there could be a constitutional convention. So it is not like a regular law that is easily changed. So and then I think the question becomes, even if you are willing to do that, right, or there might be a question of, are there things that the legislature could interpret one way or another, does that address that? But essentially, inverse condemnation, as it is in the Constitution, says, if operation causes a loss, whoever is the operator, municipal or investor-owned utility, is responsible for bearing the loss. And so I think that also what we need to look at is not only the law, but how we should change our infrastructure, because much of our infrastructure is designed a lot like it was in the 1950s. And the climate has changed dramatically since the 1950s. And in fact, some of the infrastructure out there, like one of the towers that's in question with the campfire, was 99 years old. So there are a lot of questions about the standards that may have been appropriate for the 20th century are not appropriate for the 21st century.
So there may be some other options to try to make sure we have more safe delivery of electricity in California, given the wildfire risks then?
Right, and regardless of who owns this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there may be places where perhaps the risk is less on Van Ness Avenue than it is in more forested areas, but there are risks everywhere. And then this also raises the question about, right now, since there is a large territory and there's a large ratepayer base, this also means that ratepayers who live, whether in San Jose or San Francisco, Sacramento or Fresno, help through their payments to also pay for what's going on with the need for extra tree maintenance in the forest areas. As we break that up, it actually creates issues about how do we make sure that there's enough affordability to do what you need to do, especially in the areas that have suffered from the drought and the bark beetles and that really are at the forefront of climate change. So this is also going to be important, is to make sure that we make sure that there is enough money to address those issues, both on the infrastructure side as well as making sure that people throughout California continue to get safe, reliable service that they deserve.
So at the end of the day, it's going to be more money that's going to have to come from somewhere to do a lot of this wildfire maintenance, treatment, and prevention. A lot for us to talk about there, but first I want to let listeners know this is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the future of PG&E with our guest, Supervisor Hillary Ronan from San Francisco's District 9, Severin Bornstein, Professor of Business Administration and Public Policy at the Haas School of Business and Faculty Director of the Energy Institute at Haas at UC Berkeley, and Catherine Sandoval, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University and former Commissioner for the California Public Utilities Commission, the agency that regulates PG&E. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments. The phone lines are open. What do you think should be done with PG&E? Do you think municipalities like San Francisco should create their own utilities? Do you think PG&E was justified in declaring bankruptcy? And are rolling blackouts and dry periods with heavy winds a reasonable approach to fire risks? We want to hear about your thoughts on these issues and more. Your number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on kalw.org or on our Facebook page. And you can also reach us via Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, Severin Bornstein, I want to go back to this earlier discussion we were having with Supervisor Ronan about the prospects of San Francisco taking over PG&E's assets and running PG&E as a municipal utility, the PG&E piece of the grid here in San Francisco. What is your response on the economics of this? I mean, does this sound like a sensible move for San Francisco?
Well, it could be a sensible move for San Francisco. They would definitely have to buy some infrastructure. It's important to recognize they would still be dependent on the grid outside of San Francisco to move the power from Hetch Hetchy or other locations into San Francisco. But it still might make sense for San Francisco. My concern is the larger picture. When we start talking about breaking up PG&E into pieces as small as the city of San Francisco, PG&E has a huge service territory. So we would be talking about breaking it up into a lot of companies. If they were that small, I think that's probably, we probably want to have larger areas covered by utilities than that, simply to improve coordination and so forth. But also, as Catherine alluded to, there are definitely some cross subsidies within the system. San Francisco has higher density use of its lines because people live close together, and it has very little wildfire risk. Whereas the areas, for instance, around Chico are much more forested and have lower density use of the lines. And so the cost per customer is probably higher there. If we start breaking up the utilities, we are going to have a real impact on the rates paid by particularly customers in more rural areas. That may be how we want to go, and it may be a fair allocation, but it's going to have some real political consequences when we start doing that. The other piece I think we have to recognize is it's easy to say, you know, a publicly owned utility will be better than a for-profit utility, but the record really doesn't necessarily support that. There are some great publicly owned utilities in the U.S. There are also some very good investor-owned utility, regulated investor-owned utilities. So, and it's not hard to find publicly owned utilities such as PREPA in Puerto Rico that are not well thought of, or other public agencies that are not well thought of. So public ownership isn't necessarily the solution to everything. It may be, in this case, a better outcome than PG&E. I would like to see other alternatives also explored. One, of course, would be a sale of the company, possibly in parts, to other for-profit utilities that have better records. And there are some other utilities around the country that might be interested. I have been told by many people that this inverse condemnation risk, the risk of being liable for losses even when the company is not negligent, is a real concern. It's a real concern for cities because that same liability would bankrupt cities, and it's a real concern for other investor-owned utilities. So I think there are a lot of issues we need to unpack before we actually get to the transferring the utility or breaking up the utilities and transferring ownership to a number of different either public company, public agencies or private companies.
Well, Supervisor Ronan, let me give you a chance to respond.
Yeah.
I mean, Severin raised a number of points there about any potential obligation to worry about ratepayers in other parts of the state. Are you leaving them, those folks up in Chico, on the hook? Concerns, you know, as he just mentioned, around the liability risk that the city could be taking on. I've read other concerns around the labor force that might have to be required and does even exist in San Francisco to serve the, you know, just the grid right here. So, you know, what are some of the things that you would be concerned about if San Francisco took this step, and what are your thoughts in response to some of these concerns that Severin just raised?
Sure. I want to take a couple steps back because we're not in a theoretical situation here. We have a utility whose safety record has been abysmal ever since the San Bruno explosion, then the wildfires, and even though they weren't ultimately, or PG&E wasn't ultimately found to be responsible for the Tubbs fire, they were found to have been responsible for several fires in 2017, and now we'll see what's going to happen with the Camp Fire. And then we find out the pressure that their employees are under with the gas locate and mark program. So this isn't theoretical. They're under the supervision of a judge who has called their behavior criminal. So we're in a situation where the private for-profit company who's operating our utility in San Francisco and Northern California has an abysmal record, and it's not working. And then if you look at the body that has supposed to be responsible for regulating the CPUC, and I would put forward that they've not done a great job either of performing their role. And why is that? Well, you look at the amount of money that PG&E has pumped into ballot measures, has pumped into lobbying officials, has pumped into political campaigns. If you look at these bloated salaries of their executives, this is a company that's looking and has a record of being more concerned with, helping to elect politicians that will do its bidding than to the safety and reliability of its system. So if you move that responsibility over to a public entity, you have elected officials, you have open meetings, you have all sort of business decisions made under public records, access and sunshine laws and much more transparency. And you take away those bloated salaries. I don't know a single city employee that makes a $1 million figure. We just don't even come close, even though we have rather large salaries in San Francisco. You don't see, the doubling from $4 million to $8 million salary of the outgoing CEO, Geisha Williams, like we saw between 2016 and 2017. So there's many reasons why a public utility has a much better chance of doing an excellent job running a program that not only has as its ultimate goal not profits for executives and shareholders, but an excellent, safe service for customers. That's number one. And then number two, it offers an incredible opportunity. Look, we need to attack climate change with big, bold initiatives. We need to get to 100% clean, renewable energy, tomorrow, if we could. And we need to start making those investments back into the system at rates that really are about protecting the long-term interests of our residents. And that's something that a public agency can do and have as a goal in a different way from a profit-making company.
But if San Francisco peels off its portion of PG&E, doesn't it make it harder to do some of those big climate-related goals, those big renewable energy investments, if it becomes balkanized?
Well, not from the city standpoint, but I do think that there needs to be... Look, we're not the only city and county looking at this. San Jose is looking at this. Other smaller counties are looking at this. But I do believe that there needs to be some state intervention here to look at how we can protect not just San Francisco, but the entire region, and really take a moment to say, we have so many crises that the system as is not working. It's not keeping us safe. It's not providing a cost-effective, reliable product. So let's take us a couple steps back and reimagine the system and do it 10 times better.
Well, I think you're going to find a lot of people agreeing with you on, in terms of PG&E's safety record, not a lot of defenders for PG&E, and certainly the judge you referenced has been very harsh on PG&E's safety records. So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing the future of PG&E with our guest, Supervisor Hillary Ronan from San Francisco's District 9, Severin Bornstein, Professor of Business Administration and Public Policy at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business and the Faculty Director of the Energy Institute at Haas, and Catherine Sandoval, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University and former Commissioner for the California Public Utilities Commission. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. Who do you think should bear the cost of PG&E's liabilities? We want to hear from you. To join the conversation, the number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on our website, kalw.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Amy from Pacifica calling in. Amy, welcome to City Visions.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much. I live in Pacifica, and, you know, every winter we have down power lines, live wires in the street. You know, emergency services are out protecting the roads, and, you know, it seems like it's a really huge expense. And I'm just wondering, like, in this conversation about the future of utilities in California, we need to have a discussion about, like, taking the wires actually down and putting them underground or on the ground in conduits or something like that, especially because of climate change. And we're going to have, you know, increasing winds due to increasing storms. And I'm just, you know, hoping that everybody out there in radio land can plant a seed that, you know, maybe the wires don't belong up in the air in the trees. That's all. Thanks.
No, thank you, Amy, for that question. Well, Severin, I know you do a lot of research on different costs associated with undergrounding and clean technology that's distributed. What are your thoughts in response to Amy's question about the costs and who's going to pay for undergrounding wires if that would make us safer?
Well, it is very expensive, and that, of course, is the barrier. The places that have done it have generally paid for it in local neighborhoods, and the cost would be prohibitive if most neighborhoods had to pay for it themselves. And when we start talking about undergrounding transmission lines that go through the forests, not only would it be extremely expensive, but I think there would be some real environmental concerns about digging up the land. It's just, you know, it's much less invasive to have a few towers and then string the wires across the top than to actually dig through. So there are real concerns. It still may be the right option, and the Wildfire Commission that the governor has formed, we should mention, there is a new commission that's going to look into these options. I think we'll consider that. Another possibility that I think we need to consider is de-energizing lines more frequently, meaning cutting off people's power. One of the reasons I think this makes more sense now is because storage has gotten so much cheaper. So if you live in a forested area where there's more risk of fire from the power lines, I think what we're very likely to see is more outages combined with some warnings to make sure your batteries are charged, because tonight at 6 o'clock we're going to cut off your power for 12 hours. But if your battery's charged, you can still run your refrigerator and your lights and charge your cell phone. Probably can't run your dryer or some things that are not quite as important. And I suspect we're going to see more of that as well.
So what
and
you
then
envision...
there's local mini-grid type approaches that also are a possibility, but right now those are also very expensive.
So would your, in your vision here, people would have distributed solar panels, batteries, and as you said, an alert that the power's got to shut down, it's a high wind event, dry conditions. Would we take the money that we might have spent on undergrounding wires and actually pay for people to have those types of resources, or do you think that people essentially would respond to the fact that there are now going to be a lot more blackouts and start buying these
well, that's an interesting question. Should the whole system be responsible for buying batteries for people who live in these more high-risk areas, or should they be responsible? And I'm not sure what the right answer is. Obviously, someone's unhappy either way. I'm not sure we actually need the solar panels either, though, by the way. In some places, they're probably a good idea, but in many places, the storage is the main factor, because if as long as you're connected to the grid, as almost everyone will be for decades to come, they can charge their batteries, because usually these weather events, you have some warning, 12 or 24 hours at least, and you can make sure your batteries are charged, and at that point when you get shut off, it is not as drastic an event. It's certainly not a perfect solution. It's very inconvenient, but the ones that could maintain complete convenience, undergrounding transmission lines and wires, or a distributed generation with massive storage capacity, would be extremely expensive.
And Catherine, since you were on the Public Utilities Commission, I wanted to give you a chance to respond, well, first of all, to Amy and what the Public Utilities Commission did during your time there in terms of the idea of undergrounding wires or taking safety measures, but also wanted to give you a chance to respond to Supervisor Ronan's point that maybe the Public Utilities Commission over the years has not been as strong as it could be in terms of regulatory oversight over PG&E. So I wanted to get your take on both of those issues.
Right. So first of all, I think that undergrounding makes sense in some areas. And when I was a commissioner, I voted for ratepayer spending for undergrounding in some areas. But there are places where undergrounding is going to make less sense. In fact, because of climate change and coastal flooding, in certain areas of places like Pacifica, undergrounding may make less sense because you have a huge risk of flooding of underground facilities. And that can create its own set of risks. So a few years ago, Southern California Edison had some problems in Long Beach, where a lot of its facilities are underground. There was also an older system there that had a very interesting setup. But even if you're setting it up due to newer standards, because of flooding and a variety of things, undergrounding doesn't make sense everywhere. So, you know, we need to think about where it really is appropriate in addition to the cost. I also wanted to agree with Professor Borenstein that I think that looking at distributed energy solutions, including storage, is important, because both storage and the ability to create what we call mini grids, so that you create portions of the grid that you can isolate, make it easier to turn off smaller portions of the grid, keep on other things. So that, for example, if you actually could get as small as making sure that you're keeping on the water operator so that you don't lose water to fight fires or for safe drinking water, that would be really fantastic. And that might be a way to think about, okay, maybe for the water operator or for the hospital, are there places where it's worth it for all of us as ratepayers to actually be paying for storage, for distributed storage, to make it easier to manage? I'd also like to think, and this is relevant to what Supervisor Ronan was talking about, I wanted to mention that it's important for us to look at this in terms of a variety of alternatives, right? We all agree that the governance needs to be improved. And so this is both governance at the utility level as well as the regulation level. But I think part of the problem with that governance that's happened is that PG&E was not forthcoming about problems that they knew about. For example, this whole issue with Gas Located Mark, they did an audit which basically showed they knew about these problems since 2009, and during the whole time we were working on the San Bruno decision, they were never forthcoming to raise their hand either to the PUC or to the public at large about these problems. And they should have done that. They had a duty to do that. And then the PUC said basically they found out when PHMSA, the Federal Pipeline Safety Administration, told the Safety and Enforcement Division in 2016. But then that becomes an internal investigation in the Safety and Enforcement Division that even the Safety and Enforcement Division doesn't tell the other commissioners about.
Well,
there are a lot of problems about how this, you know, whether or not they were forthcoming is part of the problem.
And what do you make of these charges? Because you do hear this, you know, the Public Utilities Commission has not been as sort of strong on PG&E regulation as they could have been. I mean, do you have any regrets about your time in terms of regulating PG&E, given what's happened subsequently? And is there a problem at the PUC in terms of its regulatory oversight over PG&E and other utilities like it?
I was one of the critics who was talking years ago about the danger to our infrastructure in terms of utility poles and part of the problems that we could see growing with poor maintenance of utility poles. And that's an issue, I would add, where the utility poles are occupied by both telecommunications companies as well as electric companies. So I was talking years ago about the need to pay attention to this infrastructure. And so there have been a number of ongoing proceedings to try to deal with that. And I know that some of the commissioners have expressed their frustration that, in fact, they haven't made more progress. So I also voted against a number of proceedings, both involving PG&E as well as some other utilities where they wanted to build power plants, and I thought that it wasn't needed. But I do feel that on this issue of the gas transmission and safety, that they lied to us. They had a duty to be forthcoming, and they didn't tell us. And so, you know, we're really at a disability to address this because they lied to us. And if they had been forthcoming, everybody would have been able to deal with these issues much earlier. And now we find ourselves in this situation. So this is part of the problem. But again, I wanted to go back to a couple of our goals here. Our goal is to improve the governance. But our goal is also to address the risks of today, which is that we have to look at how do we manage the desire for electricity and natural gas and the infrastructure necessary to provide that in light of today's climate, and also help to ameliorate the whole climate change issue. So we should be thinking as well about models such as, for example, in a number of countries like Australia, they have completely separated generation from retail, and there is a separate what they call pipes and wires company, and that is regulated. So we're going to need, however we do this, to really pay attention to how do we manage the pipes and wires, and as Professor Bornstein said, it is an interconnected system that crosses a number of systems.
So we're going to have to look at different. Models, definitely. I think around the world, as you cite. And I should mention that we did invite PG&E to come on the show, but they declined, and they sent in a statement from their interim CEO, which we posted on our website for those who are interested.
This is Severin. If I could just add one thing, there's been a lot of talk bad mouthing the CPUC through this process, and I've worked with the CPUC for more than a couple decades, and I think it's really unfair. The CPUC is a massively under-resourced organization. I have students who come out of the master's in business administration and public policy who look at the salaries they pay and just won't go work for them because they can't afford to live on those salaries, and they have a very difficult time retaining people. They don't have enough staff to do the job they're currently tasked with, which does not include detailed on-the-ground safety regulation. And as we go forward, it almost certainly is going to have to. So I think, well, it's easy to dump on the CPUC and say they didn't do their job. I think a bigger theme that we should be recognizing is we are regulating a multi-billion-dollar industry on a few million dollars, and we're really shortchanging that regulation. Mm-hmm. We should build a much more resourced organization that takes the regulatory process and the safety regulation more seriously.
I think that's an important point, and goes to the resources all around that we're going to need to address this problem. Want to let listeners know this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're discussing the future of PG&E with guest supervisor Hillary Ronan from San Francisco's District 9, Severin Bornstein, professor of business administration and public policy at the UC Berkeley Haas School of Business and faculty director of the Energy Institute at Haas, and Catherine Sandoval, associate professor of law at Santa Clara University and former commissioner for the California Public Utilities Commission. We invite you to call in with questions or comments. The number to join this conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. or post a comment on our website, kalw.org. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Matthew calling in from Berkeley. Welcome, Matthew.
Hey, yeah, I'm going to take a little contrarian position here. I'm curious if the speakers could address several major issues that have led to these fires and that really are not PG&E's fault, one of which is that 15% of the housing in California is in an extreme fire hazard zone. Much of that is caused by sprawl. Much of the sprawl is caused by our city's refusal to allow more housing in our city centers. Californians also have a tendency to prevent PG&E from cutting down trees that are in fire hazard areas. So that's something that's our fault. And I'm just curious, you know, I think Severin mentioned that this is a huge industry. It's incredibly complex. Our power lines pass through wildfire areas, through giant mountains in remote areas. And how can we possibly expect this company to maintain all of that area when we're forcing people into high fire risk areas by not allowing more housing in our cities, and we're not even letting them cut down trees because we think trees are always good all the time? Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you, Matthew, for that question. Let me direct that one to Supervisor Ronan, especially one comment there about housing, which I know is something that's under a local jurisdiction. But, you know, you're someone who's been critical of PG&E. Matthew's making some good points in defense of the company. What's your response?
Well, I mean, there's multitude of problems in California, and we definitely haven't been building enough housing in urban centers and close to people's work and where they're easily accessible by public transportation.
And not in these high fire zones.
But I don't think that giving PG&E a pass based on their safety record it makes sense either because PG&E is not responsible exclusively for climate change doesn't mean that they shouldn't have taken specific safety steps in order to prevent gas explosions and their wires from causing these wildfires. So I think that these are separate issues. Of course, they're you know, all of the major issues of the day are interrelated in certain ways. And, I really wanted to, echo and express my agreement with Professor Bornstein about the CPUC being heavily underfunded. And I think that this is sort of a theme that has allowed corporations that are responsible for sort of basic needs of human beings to put profits over those needs, and that the bodies that have historically been in place to sort of control greed and the profit motive and ensure a certain level of safety have been undermined and underfunded and chipped away little by little over time. And we see this with the CPUC. We see it with many regulatory agencies throughout the city, state, and country. I mean, if we look at what's happening in Washington, D.C., we're cutting the legs of our regulatory agencies worse than we ever have in the past. So I do think that was an incredibly important point that cannot be overstated.
And Severin, I want to let you respond to Matthew's defense of PG&E as well. What do you make of his argument that there's a lot of different factors here and that PG&E gets unfairly singled out?
Well, I'm not sure if PG&E has been unfairly singled out. I think we're going to have to wait for the reports. But I think that going forward, we have to recognize that there are multiple causes of wildfires, and when we have a lot more people moving into the wildland-urban interface where there's a lot of forests around houses, the cost of fire protection in those areas is just massively higher. And we need to do more fire protection, and it's going to cost more for the firefighting. So we need to recognize that, and maybe if you're going to live in those areas, it's going to be more expensive, or we're going to have to make a public policy decision that we are going to cover that cost at the state level. But we do have to recognize it. And I think we also have to recognize that the risks are just massively higher than they were a few decades ago. So the CPUC has historically, Professor Sandoval has made the point, they've talked to the utility, told the utility to behave safely, and then expect the utility to follow. That's not what happens in, say, the airline industry for airline safety or in nuclear power plants. There are regulators who are actually on the ground doing the regulation because the cost of making a mistake is just too high. And I think going forward, that's what we're going to have to see. We're going to see much more hands-on safety regulation, as we see in airlines and food inspection and so forth, because the costs of making a mistake just aren't the same as they were 30 years ago.
Well, we've certainly seen that with the Paradise Fire and the loss of life resulting from that wildfire. Let's go to the back to the phone lines. Connie from Berkeley. Connie, welcome to City Visions. What's your question for the panel?
Well, I mean, I was just listening to what you were saying, and I want to ask this question about funding. And I totally agree that we need more people on the ground regulating and checking situations out. But who is in charge in the state to fund the CPUC? Who funds it? And who do we have to talk to see how we can get more funding for it?
Well, that sounds like an important...
What does the legislature feel about this?
Sure. Well, that's definitely the point that Severin was making earlier about the lack of staffing at the PUC. Catherine Sandoval is a former commissioner. What's your response to Connie?
Right. So on the funding issue, the governor's office as well as the legislature makes decisions about funding. And I agree that this has been part of the problem, that there have been times in the past where the CPUC has asked for funding to example, have more inspectors to increase the number of people in certain divisions. And sometimes these funding requests have been denied. So you have what's called the budget change proposals, and then the BCPs, they call them, are denied. So the commissioners used to tease me that they're like, you act like you're the one-man band who's going around looking at utility poles. And part of what I did was, in connection with a number of different proceedings, both in urban areas and in rural areas, I got people out there to look at utility poles and made some people, some utilities, fix some stuff on the poles. But this very rarely happened, and even now, if you call the PUC and you say, hey, here's a pole and some wires where there's a problem, they don't have the manpower to always come out and do an inspection. So I think that that whole system has to be looked at, because, for example, if you contrast it with what goes on with rail, actually the federal government pays for rail inspectors. So we have people who actually go around the state and literally inspect rail lines. And you can imagine how many rail lines we have in our big state, and thus also how many miles we have of both distribution and transmission lines. It is a massive job. I also think we're going to need to look at things differently, and, you know, things like Google Street View aren't going to cut it, just that alone. But we really do need to look at making sure that the resources are there so that there is double checking, because sometimes the PUC has made requests and those requests have been denied.
So maybe one of the outcomes of this whole bankruptcy proceeding is that we end up giving more resources over to the regulators and to doing these basic safety checks. Thank you, Connie, for that call. I want to move to a slightly different topic here of renewable energy. And Severin, I can't let you go from this program without asking you what you see in your crystal ball as coming down the pike for these renewable energy developers that have signed long-term contracts with PG&E maybe 5, 6, 10 years ago at much higher rates when solar panels were more expensive. And now with the bankruptcy proceeding, it's likely that they're going to be renegotiated. What do you predict is going to happen to the renewable energy developers and the broader renewable energy push, maybe not just here in the PG&E service territory, but across California with this bankruptcy?
Well, you touched on a very important point. The bankruptcy judge will see it as his or her goal to squeeze the money out of suppliers so that there's more to pay creditors generally. And one of the ways they do that is by abrogating contracts. A lot of these suppliers signed expensive contracts because their costs were high. We were buying renewables at very high costs to help push down the cost and expand renewable integration. And if we now cut those contracts, those developers are going to be in bad shape. And just as importantly, going forward, it's going to be much harder to get developers to sign those sorts of contracts. What we're likely to see then is developers insisting on more of the money up front, because they're going to say, we're not counting on a 20-year contract to recover our investment. We need you to pay for more of the capital up front so that if something happens down the line, which of course people said this, you know, utility bankruptcy isn't going to be an issue, but now that we realize it will be again, they're going to not take that risk.
So it's a lot of uncertainty then for a very crucial technology segment of our climate change fight. So we only have a few minutes left, and I want to let each of you just provide some closing thoughts. Catherine, let me start with you, just 30 seconds or so. What do you see as the most likely thing to happen in the near term? I mean, what are you going to be looking for, you know, with this bankruptcy proceeding unfolding as sort of on the sidelines here that others should be aware of as well?
I think we need to keep our eye on the ball, and that the goal is safe, reliable service at just and reasonable rates consistent with California's environmental law. And on that point that Professor Bornstein just talked about with the renewable energy contracts, I think we're also setting up for what in the law we talk about as a preemption fight. But you can imagine a situation where if they're trying to abrogate contracts, and these contracts are one of the primary ways in which you get power, you could actually create a power problem out of bankruptcy. And we don't want to get into the point where we create a commodity problem or a power problem, and the PUC can argue, wait a minute, bankruptcy judge, you are creating a safety problem or reliability problem or an environmental problem, and you have no jurisdiction over safety, reliability, and the environment. So there's going to be a lot of legal tussles, but again, this is about keeping our eye on the ball of what we're trying to achieve in terms of today's modern climate and the risks that we face today and in the future.
All right. And Severin, 30 seconds, what are you looking for in the next few months out of this?
Well, I'm looking to the Wildfire Commission, the governor and the legislature formed, because I think the state needs a strategy on where we go from here. You know, with all due respect to the city of San Francisco and the other areas that are talking about trying to buy out and create a public-owned utility, we need a larger overarching strategy of where this is going to go, how we're going to divide up the utility if necessary, and how we're going to do that in a fair way that both treats all of the customers fairly and going forward gets us the sort of safety investment and coordination that we need.
Supervisor Ronan, last word.
Sure, yeah. I feel like that it's important that San Francisco takes advantage of this could-be-once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take over not only the generation of the power that serves our restaurants and businesses and residents, but that also we have all the other benefits that could come along with it. It's a time to take a look at what's happened, to reinvent the wheel, and to perhaps create a model in our very progressive and forward-thinking city that could be replicated elsewhere, that provides much more public benefits to the ratepayers and ensures a reliable, safe product to residents.
All right. Well, lots to look forward to and keep tabs on as we see PG&E's bankruptcy proceeding unfold. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Supervisor Hillary Ronan from San Francisco's District 9. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Severin Bornstein, Professor of Business Administration and Public Policy at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. Thank you, Severin.
Thanks for including me.
And Catherine Sandoval, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your work on these issues.
Sure, and thanks to all of you for joining me this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. And a programming note, as David LaTulipe said in the intro here, we have a new theme song. Our old one is now officially retired after 28 years of service, and you can hear it playing just in the background. I have to tell listeners that I have played a part in this theme song myself, and Kyle Muller, a professional jazz drummer, put this theme together. We hope you enjoy it. We'd love to hear from you listeners what you think of this theme. We tried to harken back to the original theme of 28 years. That one will stay on our website. We're going to put up a page for it. So for those of you who absolutely loved that theme, it'll still be listenable. But please email us, cityvisions@kalw.org, for your thoughts on that theme and, of course, any other show ideas and thoughts about the show as well. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join us again next week as host Joseph Pache sits down with acting San Francisco City Librarian Michael Lambert. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night and have a great rest of your week.